Thanks, Gary, very much. And it's very interesting to hear the comments that you made from a preparer's point of view juxtaposed against some of the comments from an investor's point of view, thus the problem, the issue, and the reason we're here today discussing this. Your comment about problem statement, and for us to have a clear problem statement in front of us, I think is important. What is it we're trying to solve? I think we've got some idea of that. We want to improve that understanding, though. And having that problem statement empirically based versus anecdotally based, we're trying to get at that also, and looking at prior studies and survey information and things of that nature. And Kurt, I don't know, hopefully you're going to present some information now on a recent survey. Would you conclude that that gives us some information that maybe starts to be empirically based in terms of what the needs are versus anecdotal?
We're hoping so. We're hoping so. You should have a copy of this, the full written report, in your materials. It's a 21-page report that goes into a lot more detail about this, and I appreciate the chance to give you a quick recap of this March 2010 survey. And again, to put a few data points around this issue of the standard auditor's report and the users or investors' perspective of the report and a little bit about the reporting model itself. Not surprisingly, the theme that emerges here is what Doug referred to earlier, that the report ought to be more broadly about the audit process and audit function and not just the financial statements. Next slide, just very quickly. The purpose really of this was for both discussion here as well as the companion discussions that are underway at the IAASB on these matters. What is the user's perception of the communicative value of this report, its usefulness, and do we need to better address the expectations gap in this report? We have a 500-member survey pool, a spot survey pool that deals specifically with these financial reporting matters that we put together, and you see here the geographic breakdown of that group. Next slide. Very high response rate to these spot surveys. Usually we had a 31% response rate. It was only open 3 days in late February, and we had 8 questions in the survey. First question, next slide. How important is the report in your investment decision-making process? And you see 72% said the auditor's report is important to their analysis, and you can see a list of some of the elaborative comments more fully in the written report that you have there, but the predominant one here, of course, is that the report is the report clean or not, and the rest of it is essentially boilerplate. Next slide. Here's an interesting question. How can you manage the expectations? 73% say describe both the nature and respective roles of the auditor and management, that would help reduce the expectations gap. Typical comments related to the need for some descriptive language about the process and nature of the audit. Next question. Survey says, this refines that last question. Would it help to ask how important it is? How important is this to the process to provide a description of the nature and the roles? And 33% said it was very important. 69% overall thought it was important to describe the nature and roles in the report itself. Next slide. Question number 4. Is there enough information about the audit process and related matters? 60% believe it needs to contain more information. In the comments, now the report is just professional lingo. A good example of useful information would be the letter that the auditor provides to the board or to the audit committee. If you look on page 12 and 13 of the written report, you're going to see a longer list of additional information on the audit process and related matters that users considered to be useful that we've put there for your review. Next slide is question number 5. It gets at what we discussed this morning at the multiple auditor issue. 91% say give us the full disclosure on specific roles played by other auditors. I don't think that the that our group, and a couple people raised this this morning, that they knew specifically what the rules, the technical rules around what appears in the audit report about a group audit. And I don't think that they necessarily care. I think whether or not it's a primary auditor situation or a reference situation, I think they want more information about the entire group if there's a group involved in this process. Next question. 82% say, tell us the method you use to assess materiality. We've heard that a couple of times today, so not new to this debate. Several said this is the most important thing you can tell users, what the auditor thinks about the materiality thresholds chosen by the management. And again, the report on pages 16 and 17 has a longer list of materiality metrics, potential materiality metrics there. Next question. This was the closest question on results. 57% to 40% say that the report needs more information on the audited entity. And comments centered around more entity-specific information. You can see a list of those on page 19, things like the adequacy of the risk management process and internal controls, how do they deal with off-balance sheet issues, and discussing, again, some of the significant judgment issues and items that are they're part of the financial reports. Last slide, finally, what additional information would you like to see? First of all, 94% of the respondents said they want more information. The favorites you see here, the audit materiality, any issues related and surrounding the issue of auditor independence and conflicts in that regard, the level of assurance that was achieved in the audit. And the next slide gives you a little bit longer list of some of the additional information that would be useful to investors. So that's it. I'm happy again to have this in the mix for our discussion here today, at least some useful, maybe not all new, but it's at least some useful data points on what users and investors are thinking about this topic.
Thank you, Kurt. And just to clarify, what you have in your packets are actually the slides and not the full report. We'll have that available for you tomorrow morning, and we'll email you an electronic version. So you'll be able to, if you took notes on those page numbers, you'll be able to look at them. No, Sam, you didn't?
No, I didn't.
Okay. We'll provide a roadmap to you, similar to the French model. Well, right now we have about 25 minutes left for questions and comments before we go into the breakout sessions. I'd like to open it up to the floor to the SAG members and observers, and looks like Hal is the first one, so go ahead, Hal.
Kirk, I just wanted to ask a question about the first question in the survey. Preponderance of people said it was important to them to in making an investment decision, the opinion. I'm curious as to how that could be because you only get the opinion once a year, and it's many months after the fact. So why did you delve into why it was an important part of their investment
decision? Yeah, we didn't get into any additional detail other than what you see here with the question. But, you know, I think anybody that's looking at making an investment, regardless of what time of year it is, you're looking back to see if it was a clean, you know, if there was a clean opinion, right?
Yeah. I would challenge that, but we can talk more about that later. Okay.
Sam?
I have a couple of questions as well for Kurt. In terms of just trying to understand who answered the questions, how many members are there of CFA Institute?
There are a lot.
More than 500?
There's about 100,000 globally, yeah.
Okay. And who are the 500 members that were chosen to answer this particular survey? What distinguishes them from the other 99,500?
Again, this is, as I explained up front, this is a spot survey pool that we put together specifically for the topical issues related to financial reporting. So they have an interest in tracking what's going on with financial reporting standard setting as well as presumably audit issues as well.
Does that mean the other 99,500 are not interested in financial reporting? I'm just trying to understand how representative this is of your population of analysts. That's all.
Well, again, all I can tell you is that it's a group of our members that have been indicated some specific interest in these types of issues, and I think it's very representative of the rest of the group.
Of the broader group.
Broader group, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
I'm just putting up the specific topics we're going to be talking about in the breakout sessions to remind you of the content, the form, and then looking at the fraud. Are there any other general questions or comments that you have? Galen?
Yeah. We usually say fraud since you brought that up, and it has been brought up a number of times. But I would assume, since the auditing standards usually, there's this phrase, fraud or error or fraud from whatever. So we're really covering both, are we not? Not just fraud in our discussion. Marty,
it seems to me like we're covering both. The auditing standards say the audit is designed to provide reasonable assurance that the financial statements are free of material misstatement, whether due to error or fraud.
Or fraud.
Correct.
Doug?
Just a general comment on that issue. The communicating the responsibility better in the audit report presumes that we know what the responsibility is and that it's articulated clearly in the standards, I think. And I think that that's probably not true. It's a problem because people want that information in the audit report. And if there were a clear articulation of the responsibility and everybody understood it, then it might be feasible to try to present a condensed version of that in the report. But I think where we are now, there isn't a very clear articulation of that responsibility. And the standards say the auditors to obtain reasonable assurance of whether the financial statements are free of material misstatement from error or fraud. But the standards also go on to describe various aspects of concealment, such as falsified documents and collusion. And you find great disagreement among people. Some people say, well, I think mistakenly, that when there's fraud and collusion, that the auditor can't detect. When there's collusion and falsified documents, the auditor can't detect fraud, which I don't think is true. But on the other hand, there are certain circumstances where those things might impede the auditor's ability to detect fraud. So I don't think we have a clear articulation in the standards, and I think that that would have to precede any attempt to condense the explanation of it in the audit report.
Doug, are you pointing that out? You think that's a deficiency in the way the standards are written, or do you think it's a broader issue that there isn't general agreement on a certain issue?
I think it's perhaps a deficiency in the standard, but I don't want to attribute that just to the standard. I think that the standards are reasonably clear, except they confuse a few things. There's a very clear statement of what the responsibility is, but then there are comments on concealment and collusion and falsified documentation that I think confuse things in some people's mind. And I think a clearer articulation, the people that have looked at it and spent a lot of time trying to come up with criteria where you could specify in advance those frauds an auditor should detect in an audit in accordance with the standards and those frauds an auditor should not detect in accordance with the standards have really concluded that that's impossible, that you really need to look at, you've got general things like due professional care, consideration of risk, and so on, and you have to look at the specific circumstances of the particular fraud and what was done, and then evaluate in those specific circumstances whether it would have been reasonable for the auditor to detect the fraud or not. And it has proven impossible to articulate in a conceptual way criteria that would clearly inform people in advance whether a particular fraud should be detected or not.
Both Doug and I have referenced the standard a couple of times, and that it says an audit is to be designed and performed to determine that the financial statements are free of material misstatement, whether due to error or fraud, to provide reasonable assurance in that regard. The previous SAG discussions and PCAOB literature discussed what reasonable assurance was and said that reasonable assurance is a high level of assurance. The standards do go on to say, though, after the sentence I just articulated, that absolute assurance, however, is not attainable, and even an audit that is properly designed and performed may not uncover all material errors or material fraud. So the standards say that now, and I guess, Doug, to your point, I guess some of that with the other examples of types of fraud in there is the clarity and the confusion in the same standards. A couple of other cards are up over here. I think, I'm not sure, John?
I'm only going to be in one of the breakout groups, so I thought I'd at least throw out some thoughts that maybe the other two groups could think about since they won't hear me raise these in the one I'm in. And I hear the investor viewpoint and the preparer viewpoint that have been expressed. I found myself stepping back for a second and thinking about just, I'll call it the disclosure viewpoint. And it seems like to me the goal in this area that we're looking for is, I don't know, to choose a couple words, good, robust, understandable, clear disclosure. I mean, that's really what we're looking for, and the question is to try to figure out how best to get there. I guess I first listened to these different possible new disclosures, and I first put them into two categories. One are the ones that I will call them are informative disclosures, but at the end of the day become relatively standardized. And the other category are the ones that I will call the customized disclosures. And I'll just shorthand that to say this auditor's disclosure or discussion and analysis, but where you're actually customizing it to the business of the company. And I guess with the informative disclosures, those all sound good. I mean, that we can get there with different ones of those, but at the end of the day, they're going to be standardized, and the opinion would get longer, but they're still just the informative disclosures. When you start talking about the customized disclosures, I guess my first reaction is you end up with potentially two different competing disclosure documents. You've got the company's disclosures, which are in the financial statements and in the MD&A, and then you've got another auditor's disclosure document. And I guess to the extent what I want to understand, and I'm a little confused by, is to the extent those two are different, that doesn't sound like a long-term sustainable position for the company to be in. It sounds like you've almost got to gravitate maybe very quickly to one version. You can't be there and have your auditor saying something different about your disclosures than something different than the company is saying. And I, in fact, think you end up probably gravitating towards where the auditors are as opposed to where the company is because just the nature of the process. But in any event, I hope people could talk about it. Is it really a sustainable model to have two different sets of disclosure out there? And I guess the other thing that occurs to me, which I think would be useful to talk about, is, I mean, over the years, the process of disclosure in terms, you've got the company putting disclosure together, but there have been a series of, I think one of the magic words are gatekeepers, and auditors are gatekeepers. With the audit committee is a gatekeeper in a capital raising transaction. The underwriters are gatekeepers. And I think the role of gatekeepers has all been to work with the company in, you know, each of those three categories to improve the one set of disclosure that you have for the company. And I guess I'm trying to understand why we want to have two sets of, I'm going to call it, competing disclosures that I eventually think isn't a sustainable model, versus figuring out how to give tools to the gatekeepers, tools to the auditors, to the audit committee, so that they can get better, they can help the company get to one set of better disclosure. But anyway, that's my series of questions for the different groups.
Thanks, and I think that's additional good input for all of us to consider in our breakout sessions. And we could arrange for you to be at all three breakout sessions, but not at the same time, though. It's very possible that Jeff, sitting next to you, might have some thoughts in that regard. Is that true, Jeff?
Thank you. Because of the timing of my executive director's maternity leave, I was fortunate enough to join Lynn and Galen and the others you mentioned on that subcommittee. So I spent a number of months, and this was an issue that when I asked people, and I asked a lot of accountants, current and former auditors, as well as investors, during this several-month period, if they were in my place, what is the one thing that they would recommend that they thought might improve the auditing profession? And several of the people that I spoke to and respect listed this as their number one item. And I believe there is substantial evidence, a lot of it anecdotal, but there is some empirical evidence as well, some of which is referenced in the studies and surveys cited in the paper, that, as Lynn said, the key customers of the auditor's report, who I believe are investors, are not being delivered a product that fully meets their needs. I think that's absolutely clear. And I guess going back to what Gary said, I think the board needs to ask themselves, what's our mission and who are we serving? And if your conclusion is we're serving investors and other users of financial statements, then I think the evidence is pretty clear that there needs to be a change here. One way that you can improve the product, before I talk about improving the product, there is evidence, and some cited in your paper and that the Treasury Committee found, is that there is some value to being able to quickly look at the audit opinion and see whether or not it's a unqualified opinion. So I would propose that we keep that. And I would support this supplemental idea that we add some type of supplemental report to the standard report so we don't lose the fact that there is some value there to investors in the pass-fail report. I would propose that the supplemental report include the type of information that any owner or potential owner of a company would be interested in obtaining from a team of auditing experts. More specifically, I believe many users of financial reports, and this was presented by some of the people who testified before us at Treasury, would like to obtain more information from the external auditor about company transactions, risks and uncertainties, information about management judgments and estimates that the independent auditor might have disclosed differently or might have accounted for differently if the independent auditor had been the party responsible for preparing the financial statements. I believe that this is the type of information that many investors would view as enhancing the value of the independent audit. And if we enhance the value of the independent audit, there's a lot of, or could be a lot of positive side effects to that, including improving the quality of financial reporting, improving the quality of auditing procedures, improving the perceived value of the audit itself and the fees paid for that audit. Mr. White indicates that that type of two-reporting model might not be sustainable, but that might be true, but I think it would drive us to a place where it could improve the quality of reporting, could, as I said earlier, improve the quality audit procedures, potentially improve the overall perception by investors of the quality of the audit, and again, that could have positive impacts on the audit fee issue that we talked about a little earlier. Thank you.
Jeff, thank you for your comments. Wayne Carnell?
Thanks, Barney. Actually, just a short question, if I may, or perhaps two aspects of it. One of the slides that said people are favoring disclosure of the method of determining materiality, and my question is that more from an audit scope perspective, or is that the materiality that management is using to determine, you know, what disclosures or how they are actually preparing the financial statements? And the second part of the question is, what would be envisioned that would be disclosed to comply with this objective?
I'm assuming that's directed to me. Again, the question is, as you see it here, there was no differentiation or any of that kind of nuance in the question. You'll see in the full report, the written report, a list of elaborative comments that I think will make that more clear for you. Okay.
Lynn Turner.
Back to your question, Wayne. At the time we did SAB 99, at the very tail end of the process, we did get a really good letter in on the issue that I wish we had got in at the fore part of the project. We may have incorporated it into audit committee discussions if we had a. But it did focus on the notion of having companies disclose their materiality. And it wasn't audit planning material because people were focused on what is actual the numbers in the financial statements at year end. And so it was the final determination of materiality. You know, what is that final number? What is or isn't material? And that was certainly the focus of the letter at the time. Serving on a number of audit committees, I've always asked the auditor, what's your assessment of materiality? Just so as a member of the audit committee, I had an understanding of what, at the end of the day, the materiality was. And it usually comes up in the context of when the auditors do the reporting on adjustments. And quite often these days, it just goes away because there's no issue because everyone's booked the entries, so then you don't have to worry about it. But you can, I suspect other people on audit committees also, turn around and ask the auditor, what is it that you're assessing as material or not, and what are those numbers? And I've never had an auditor tell me they can't tell me that number. They've always been actually very good at explaining the number and how they got to it. So I think it's a reasonable request, and I can clearly understand why investors would want to know that. In fact, I would say it's not an audit issue. It's probably something for an accounting standard setter where the accounting policy footnotes probably, since this is a significant item, probably ought to just be in the accounting policy footnotes.
The observation I had, and Lynn, is as you probably know better than anyone in terms of SAB 99, and one of the very good aspects of it is not just a simple materiality. It's not X percent of net income. It's when you're looking at materiality, there's lots of disclosures, there's other information. So when you're making an assessment for materiality, I think it's a lot broader than just saying it's X percent of net income. It's including the financial statements in their totality. That's what I was wondering in terms of how you would express that assessment in an opinion.
Sam?
I'd like to pick up on that point. And I'm going to feel really bad because if you had asked me that question, I don't know if I had known how to answer it, but it appears I'm the only one in the profession that doesn't. Including some of my partners, but I gotcha. So this is an educational session for me, and I apologize for the rest of the group. But I wonder if, I don't know how to answer what is material to the financial statements of company XYZ, because different things will have different materiality concepts. And I think SAB 99 was designed to say the qualitative factors can have as much or more of an impact on your assessment of materiality than just quantitative factors. Now, I can understand where an auditor would say to an audit committee, here's my audit difference posting threshold, which is a concept that says, when I go through my work, if I find a difference less than X, I don't accumulate it. I don't bother the audit committee or management with it. It's just simply inconsequential. And I'm not concerned about when I set that threshold, aggregation risk. I take that into account, but I don't have every one of the errors in the company's books are $1 less than my posting threshold. And I wonder if that's what they're responding to, because I would say that is not the materiality to those financial statements. I mean, is that the information that they're giving you? Is over a certain amount I post an audit difference, otherwise I don't?
There's more to it than that, okay? There's a baseline of here is where we would start what we would consider material, okay? And they're usually very sensitive to this, because I don't think any auditor wants to, at the beginning of the audit, nail down, this is it, because you haven't gone through that audit process. But at the end, when you're down through the process, okay, if you have adjustments, and in most cases, we haven't had to worry about it that much then, because people these days just tend to book them. They just don't like to have to deal with that issue, and it's the right thing to do anyway. But if you get down to that point, it's also, though, okay, so we had X percent of assets is what we considered material, and the focus is, for whatever reason, tends to be much more on the assets than on the revenue P&L side, okay? But also, here's how we assessed it on the P&L, but we'd also consider these other factors. In one particular case, it got down to, quite frankly, the assets and revenues didn't matter because we were close to a break-even type situation. So in the break-even type situation, all that stuff went away, and it really did become a percentage of the bottom line in that case that drove it, because it was also where you were in a loss or positive position. So those items all came into it in that particular situation. So that's where the discussions were. But ultimately, at the end of the day, you do have to decide whether things are material or not. I mean, we do say in all material respects. So ultimately, at the end of the day, the company first has to decide what is or is not material. It'd be difficult as an investor to sit there and get into a conversation where the company couldn't tell me what's material, and then the auditor said, I can't tell you what's material because it's too judgmental. It'd leave an investor saying, well, then how do you reach a conclusion about whether it's material or not? So, there's... Wayne's point on SAB 99, that's what SAB 99 says. But at the end of the day, someone does have a concept of what is or is not material. Because if you can't put that number out and disclose it, you probably got bigger problems that the investor would like to know about.
Lynn, do you think there's one number that you would disclose? Because I guess, again, to the qualitative factors, I would say an error on a balance sheet might have a higher precision or a higher degree of materiality than one that affects net income. Same with the cash flow statement based on the industry or the entity itself, what might be material to the P&L may not be material at all to the cash flow statement. And then you get into the footnotes and what's material to items in the footnote, which all goes to things that we consider from a qualitative perspective. And I struggle with just putting out one number, and maybe preparers do have a number in mind that anything over a certain amount is just material, but I struggle with that personally.
But again, I haven't heard anyone say just put a number out there, but tell us how you decided what was or wasn't material. So it's going to be a combination of things, most likely, depending upon. Probably the best statement is we had no adjustments we didn't book, so who cares? Okay? That'd probably be the best disclosure each time. But if you're having to assess materiality, and I understand accountants struggle writing, but it seems to me that you ought, if you can't communicate in clear, plain English as to how you made that assessment, be it you started at 5% or 3% or 6% or whatever those numbers are, because everyone lays that out of planning. But at the end of the day, we also consider these items and be able to put that into a paragraph. If you can't write that down, then I'd be very concerned as an investor as to exactly what is going on here. I'd be concerned the CFO couldn't do it, because that's, personally, I think that's where it has to start. And if an auditor couldn't tell me, I'd be even more concerned, because it's the auditor's role to decide what's material or not and concur.
For some reason, I thought we needed to get into breakout sessions to have this lively back-and-forth dialogue, so silly me. Jamie Miller?
I guess first let me just say on the materiality standards that I think they're quite good as they're written today, and I think they provide good guidance in terms of the thought process around making materiality decisions. I think they've played an important role in ensuring that judgment items or items of a certain quantitative threshold do get the right vetting amongst both management, auditors, and the audit committee. But I also agree with Lynn that disclosures around governance, whether they be the quantitative thresholds, whether they be what items are discussed with the audit committee or which items were debated between management and the auditors, are probably best left for accounting standard setters or SEC disclosure rulemaking process, simply because I think it does come back to the role of management as the primary force in that discussion. You know, setting that aside, I did want to make a comment about just standard form of auditors' reports versus other qualitative disclosure on the part of auditors. I'd be very concerned about moving away from a standard form of an auditor report and having something like an auditor discussion and analysis. You know, I think the standard form of audit opinion has played a very important role in ensuring quality across the board in the audit process. And if we had an unqualified, but make sure you read this, or an unqualified, but, you know, make sure you understand this aspect, I think we'd have many different flavors of opinions in front of us, and I actually think we'd be doing investors a disservice in terms of helping them to know how to interpret those or to draw comparisons between companies of similar size and similar industries. And I think if we think about the standard auditor report as setting a very high bar for a minimum standard of quality, both in procedures, in assessing GAAP compliance and GAS compliance, but in also in terms of materiality and auditor communications, I think we have to focus on raising the bar across the board, which really gets back to making sure that GAS, as we set it, is explicit enough or does have the right hooks to make sure that auditors are thinking about or taking into account in their procedures the right things. But I'd be very uncomfortable having it be a company-specific judgment or decision or almost allowing grades or tiers of disclosure from the auditors. So I would caution against having that form of qualitative discussion, because I think it could be easily misinterpreted and maybe not move towards the objective of raising quality.
Thanks, Jamie. One of the reasons we wanted to have breakout sessions on this, and as I articulated in introducing this subject, there obviously is a tremendous debate around these issues, and there are very different positions by different parties, preparers, investors, et cetera. And the breakout sessions, we do hope to get to really have some time to dig down into some of these points as to the practicality of, I think John teed it up before, the sustainability of a supplemental report, and what would that ultimately look like, and how would that change over time, and would what the auditors said ultimately become, well, management would have to say the same thing because they just wouldn't want to have two different messages or not. So we wanted to dig down into that, and for those who thought reports should change exactly, how do you think they should change? How would that benefit investors? Jamie's pointed out maybe investors would get a disservice because that supplemental report might seem to couch in some way the otherwise statement that the financials present fairly. So I think there's a lot on the table. There's a couple of cards up. I'd like to hear from those folks in the context of additional things for us to think about in the breakout sessions. But I think we have Wayne, Arch,
Hal.
And Hal have cards up. And if we can hear from those three folks, and then we'll move to breakout.
Okay, I'll be brief. On the materiality issue, materiality does have many threads of different colors, and one color that wasn't addressed was the color of disclosure, because disclosure quite often is not quantitative. So in terms of disclosing what materiality was used, there's no number. It's a question of how appropriate the disclosure was in conveying the facts of the situation. And a few words one way or the other can have a significant impact. So, you know, in looking at the materiality issue, you can't ignore the disclosure aspect of it.
Arch.
Yeah, thanks, Marty. You know, it's not surprising to me that if people are asked if they want more information in order to help them make decisions, they inevitably will say yes. But part of the issue is how to use the information that they would be provided and how to use that information appropriately. So in my mind, enough information would have to be provided for any user to be able to put the information in an appropriate context. And to do that clearly and efficiently and effectively certainly is going to be an important and, I think, very difficult challenge as we continue to debate this. When Lynn speaks about the discussions that he has with auditors, those are not one-sentence discussions. I'm sure that there's a lot of context that is put around those types of decisions. And so the challenge would be if we decide to have some change to the auditor's report to try and capture that information, how do you put information in context so that it is used appropriately and clearly understood?
Just to follow on Wayne's comments, I would agree. Sometimes the disclosures are far more important than the actual numbers on the balance sheet. And, you know, Lynn, I thought I knew in, you know, during 13 years of auditing what materiality was, and then I got on the other side of the investment world, and my perceptions of materiality have dramatically changed. And sometimes I'm much more interested in the footnote disclosures and, you know, non-performing assets and looking at those trends where, you know, that one little change, $1 million or here or there, may make more of a difference in my conclusion than anything you could do to the balance sheet or income statement. Because a lot of times we're looking for the turn in the economy, the recovery of the credit cycle, if you will, and either that will either support or refute our what we've already done in terms of investing. So.
Thank you. Well, thanks, everybody. I thank you. For the panelists for introducing this subject and giving us your points of view, and especially from the advisory committee and the auditing profession, the basis for this recommendation and for us to look at the Standard Auditor's Report and and consider changes to it. I think the paper that we sent out, the briefing paper, teed up a lot of issues and questions. We'll have those questions for discussion at our breakout sessions. In addition, a lot of other information was set forth here by various SAG members for us to thoughtfully think about as part of this dialogue. Before we break, however, I just wanted to make an announcement. Some of you might see this on your, everybody's looking through from time to day on their BlackBerries and their iPods, et cetera. The PCOB has just issued, and you'll see a press release coming out, it's been issued already, Staff Audit Practice Alert number 5. I'll talk about this in some more detail tomorrow. Auditor considerations regarding significant unusual transactions. It's a practice alert to auditors. Significant unusual transactions, especially those close to period end or outside of the ordinary course of business, often can pose difficult substance over form issues. And the auditor's evaluation of those significant unusual transactions is a critical part of the auditor's responsibility as part of their interim reviews or their annual audits. So this practice alert pulls together substantial guidance from existing auditing literature, I think in a very cohesive way, for how the auditor should identify those transactions, respond to them, communicate them to audit committees, and discuss with their clients appropriate disclosure of these types of transactions. So this alert has been issued. Copies of it will be available later today out on the front desk for you to read. And I'll be talking about it in some more depth tomorrow when I go over current standard-setting activities. So with that, I think the breakout sessions, Bella, maybe you could give some guidance on that.
We're going to take about a we're running a few minutes behind, so maybe we can take a 20-minute break. The breakout sessions are closed to the public, and we'll convene in the same room where you had lunch today. There's breakout sessions room A, B, and C. The group that you've been assigned to is actually in your folders. There will also be PCOB assistants that will help you and direct you to the appropriate room. Feel free to grab a snack on your way into the breakout session. Tomorrow we'll convene at 8:30 in the morning, and for those individuals sitting around the table, if you want to leave your folders here overnight, anything that's a non-personal item, you can feel free to do so. Housekeeping will not take it away. I would recommend taking any computers and laptops and things with you. Not sure they would actually be able to stay here the whole night. Any questions? Okay, then thank you very much, and we'll see you shortly in the breakout rooms.